So we've been practicing together now for a little over one day since we arrived and entered into this retreat together. And I'd like to just take some time to it sounds like we need to arrange some translation. We have a translator, thank you. And does anyone need translation who's not there? Okay, it's been taken care of. Great. Thank you. So I'd like to just offer some reflections on what we're doing and really the context and the framework that makes sense of what we're doing. It can sometimes be that when we look at each other or at ourselves, particularly if we're doing this for the first time, it can seem a little strange, and we may kind of wonder why on earth we are doing this, sitting around, wandering back and forth, doing very little it seems, and perhaps we might say going nowhere fast. You know this expression, going nowhere fast? It's sort of, if you don't know it, don't worry. But it's interesting, isn't it, that what we're doing here, we might read a description of a retreat and it sounds like it would be a lovely thing. And there can be many elements of it, of course, that are lovely, enjoyable, sweet. And there can be some ways in which that's not always our experience. There was a study that was undertaken, in fact, a couple of studies in America last year that I read about in the newspaper, where they invited some people to just spend 10 or 15 minutes sitting on a chair doing nothing. And they were expecting that this would not be such a big problem for them, but they weren't sure. And it was very interesting how difficult people found it just to sit somewhere doing nothing. That's all they were told to do. They were allowed to think. They just had to sit there and do nothing. And as the article said, they gave these people the opportunity, if they wish, to administer to themselves an electric shock. Now, all of them were shown the electric shock before they did this, and all of them said, if you gave me the choice, I would pay you money rather than have the electric shock. This is part of the process. And then once they were sitting there by themselves, a very large proportion of them chose to give themselves an electric shock as a preference to having to just sit there doing nothing. Very interesting. And the researchers were very curious about this. But I think it has something to say about what we're doing here. They said, what is striking is that simply being alone with their thoughts was apparently so painful and difficult, it drove many participants to self-administer an electric shock that they had earlier said they would pay to avoid. We don't give the option of the electric shock here. As a way of providing some more entertainment or something preferable to sitting around doing nothing. But I found, you know, the topic or the title on the article in the newspaper was how sitting around doing nothing proved to be shockingly difficult. Now, just want to name also that I'm experimenting a little here with me and with you, and that I have my notes on a piece of technology that I don't really know how to use very well, so they may disappear, and we'll see what happens if that's the case, or I may have to go looking for them. But when we were standing outside this afternoon in the circle, as many were standing, and I just had really the sense of something very beautiful, something very noble expressed, and that willingness just to come and stand. And perhaps it was hot, perhaps it was not comfortable or easy to be there, and yet that sense of what is it that brings us to engage in this practice? What is it that keeps us here? Because really, although we give you suggestions and instructions, we can't make you be here. This is something that you bring, that you give, that you offer to yourself and in the process of the retreat. And I think we do so because as human beings we have some sense, we have some intuition or some understanding. Even if we can't explain it to ourselves, we have some understanding that there is a possibility, a potential within us that goes beyond what we might have imagined, that is not limited by the things that we find difficult or uncomfortable in life, and that we're interested to know and to discover for ourselves. It seems like one of the things that happens when we come on retreat, and it seems like kind of bad news in a way, but we discover, if we haven't already before we got here, we discover how much time we spend being actually disconnected, how much time we spent kind of a long way away from where we are. The instruction seems quite simple. Just pay attention to the breathing. I imagine we could ask some people who'd never tried to do it before. Mostly they'd say, oh yeah, I could do that. Wouldn't be too hard. Just a few minutes paying attention to the breathing, sitting around doing nothing. If you've never tried it, it sounds easy. But when you try it, you realize, wow, this isn't easy at all. At least some of the time, it can be quite challenging. And to notice how it seems, despite our good intention to be present, to follow the instruction and to practice the meditation, how enthusiastically it seems our mind wants to go somewhere else, looks to go somewhere else. Did any of you notice this today at any point? The great and much-loved teacher in Thailand of the 20th century, Ajahn, which means teacher, Buddhadasa, who was once asked to describe the world, and he responded using just three words. He said, lost in thought. And I think a very interesting and informative response. We easily live our lives lost in thought. It's not to say in meditation practice we're not saying that thinking is bad or wrong. In fact, it's necessary. None of us would have got here without it. None of us would have even got to this sitting down for this talk. And certainly I wouldn't have anything to say without the capacity for thinking. But we become lost in the world of thought. And in that, we become disconnected. We find ourselves out of touch with what's actually going on at the deeper level of heart and mind and body. And it's important we take responsibility for this, but we do not blame ourselves. It's not somehow that we are failures at meditation if we find it difficult to be present, if we find ourselves easily or frequently drawn away into unconscious thinking. But to take responsibility for it is really important, without blaming ourselves or the conditions that give rise to this pattern of becoming lost in thinking. I recently heard from someone who attended a course I was teaching of he called it a maxim of Stoicism, the Stoic tradition from ancient Greece. And they say in that tradition apparently that those who are unlearned, who have no learning, they blame others. Those who are beginning to learn blame themselves. But those who have learned blame no one. And I think very interesting, we start to take responsibility, we start to see there is a choice. Yes, it's true, there is a choice. We can be more awake, more present. But it's really important that in doing that we understand that the forces and the patterns of conditioning we're dealing with are powerful. And they're not something we in ourselves have created or chosen. So when we seek to engage with this process of being awake, of being more present, to do so really in a spirit of seeing what's possible for me. What's possible right here, right now, this time, and again we have that opportunity. Not making some kind of measurement or judgment or evaluation of how well I am doing or how not so well we are doing, which tends to be more the way it goes. at least for some of us. And yet to be interested to see what's going on here. How does it come to be so difficult to do this? The simple thing, to be present. We can all do it for a moment, or two, three, four, five, and then somewhere it seems we disappear. When that happens, to notice and actually be grateful that you notice. Take some, we could say, a moment to appreciate the fact that we become aware we're no longer present. This is something actually to celebrate. This is an expression of our possibility for being more awake. That we notice we're not awake is actually good. If we didn't notice, we could be in the unconscious mode for days, years, perhaps lifetimes. And actually this is the story of much of the world around us. If we look, we see that's what's happening. So in this, we are asked also to look at the particular forces and patterns of mind and heart that draw us, that pull us, that take us away. It's not a random thing. It's not an accidental event that we become lost in the reactivity, in the disconnectedness of the stories of our minds. Much of it comes down to the way in which we are driven by the forces of fear and desire into seeking for, pursuing one experience, trying to avoid or get rid of another. And this basic pattern shows itself in the way we get drawn into the thinking about the past, trying to figure out how things happened in the past. So if they were bad things, we can make sure they don't happen again. Or if they were good things, we can try and repeat them. And we go from that thinking about what happened in the past to looking then and trying to think about what will happen in the future, trying to make sure, and this is in broad terms, but mostly we're trying to make sure there's more of the good things, in fact, hopefully only the good things, and none of the bad things, or at least less of the bad things, or what we find difficult. And when we see it that way, it's like, oh, okay, this is a certain patterning of the mind. That's all that it is. It's not something to judge, but we do need to understand it. And to understand that this process is something we can transform, but we need to be willing to see it and how it plays out for us, how it affects us, because it gives us the sense, and it's really an illusion, that it serves us, that it contributes to our well-being. The idea that, hey, when I like things, why shouldn't I try and get more of them? Yeah, there is a certain okayness about that in terms of our basic needs and allowing ourselves to enjoy things that we enjoy, sure. But I remember, for instance, once on a retreat, very similar to this, when the cooks made a meal that I really like. Now, I don't know if you like lasagna, but it's a very particular sort of thing. It's not particularly Middle Eastern food, I don't think. But I like it, and I like it a lot. And one day on the retreat, they served this meal, and I was so excited, thinking, wow, I love this. I'm going to be so happy. It's going to be so good. And as I stood in the queue getting closer, I was more and more excited. And then when I got there, I tried to be modest. Not too much, not greedy. No, just enough. Or a little bit more than was my share and a good amount. And taking it back to sit down and eat, I was thinking about maybe there'll be enough for a second helping. Maybe I can get some more of this. It was really yummy, very tasty. And as I ate this meal of lasagna, you know what lasagna is? Those pastry sheets, a vegetarian version of lasagna. It was very nice. I was just thinking about, will I get there in time to get some more before everyone else gets it? And I really wanted extra. I wanted more. So I wasn't really enjoying eating the lasagna. I was more worrying about getting more of it. And you know, the tragic thing was, by the time I'd finished eating that lasagna, I was so full, my stomach was sort of fat, and it was actually painful, and I didn't want any more, and I hadn't enjoyed what I had. Does that sound like something you recognize? Sometimes it's so hard for us to enjoy something we enjoy, because we're worried about how much of it we can get, or how long we can keep it, or whether we can have it again. We can't just be there and say, oh, this tastes good. And just enjoy it. So in this way, we start to consider, we start to ask ourselves, what's going on with me? What's going on with this world where we're so much rushing for more? For more, it seems. Or for something different or something else. What we start to feel when we stop, when we start to sit and walk and stand, is we start to feel the way that challenges the more unconscious or unacknowledged momentum or force or pressure that we're often under the influence or at times in the control of, that we're being driven by, that says in many different ways somehow that we must get somewhere else, or we must have a different experience, or we must somehow fix or control what's happening in order to be happy, in order to be fulfilled, in order to discover peace, well-being, or whatever it is that we long for in our lives. And that sense comes from an underlying idea that there's something missing, there's something lacking, there's something that needs to be added to or taken away from this experience of being alive the way it is right now, in order for us to really be okay here, in order for us to deeply, to find a deep sense of satisfaction and well-being. And yet, what happens with this is that very process creates the experience that we're trying to get away from. That very process of always looking to the future, to the past, of always evaluating or judging our experience as to whether this will get me where I want to be or keep me from where I don't want to be. That very process keeps us distant from the experience itself. And someone wrote a note this afternoon asking, noticing the tendency to always be judging experience, whether it be the breath, whether it be the thinking mind or something, that we're always wondering, is it good, is it bad? And referring to that. With that tendency, it's really helpful to notice it. It's great that you did, whoever wrote the note, and I'm sure others have noticed it too. It's not that we have to stop our mind from doing that, because we're not trying to suppress the activity of the mind, but we want to see what's happening and to have the space not to act on it. Which means when the mind says it's good, that doesn't mean we have to try and keep it or make it happen more. When the mind says it's bad, we don't have to get rid of it or imagine somehow that it's wrong that it's here. What we need to do is look and see what's happening in the relationship to this experience. What's going on here? And we notice that generally when the experience is pleasant, pleasurable, enjoyable, nice, flattering, we think it's good, and I like it, and I want some more of it. And when it's uncomfortable, or painful, or unfamiliar, and therefore a little scary perhaps, or not very flattering, so we don't feel it makes us look very good, like we're walking along in meditation, trying to do mindful walking meditation, and then we lose our balance and almost fall over. I don't know if this happens to you, but for me also sometimes, and I've been doing a lot of walking meditation in my life, and still sometimes it's like a baby learning to walk. You get it wrong and you almost fall over, because we learn to do walking unconsciously. And in the practice here, we're relearning to do it consciously, which means if you get distracted, you lose balance. So in that moment, it seems to me at least obvious, anyone can tell, while I'm almost falling over, probably I got distracted, and that's true, I did. And maybe you do too on occasion. But we see those experiences. In a certain way, one can also hold it lightly in such situations. But the way we're judging and evaluating experience leads us to stay, again, somewhat removed from it. And the practice is asking us to see, how close can I come? How intimate can I be with this experience? And to not assume I know what it has to offer me. To not say, it's good, just because it feels pleasant. Or it's bad just because it feels unpleasant. Check it out and see. Maybe it's something harmful. You know, if I stand on something sharp, maybe it could hurt my foot. I need to take care. But sometimes it's just a little something sharp, but it's not actually dangerous. And one can just feel, huh, it's like this to stand on a small stone with my foot. Huh, it's okay. That's one reason it's good to go slowly and gently. So we can actually tell what's happening. We can look and see what's useful. When the attitude is much more that sense of trying to get our experience to be comfortable, to be easy all the time, what we notice is there's a way in which we're leaning forward, always drawn towards the next thing. And we think, you know, it's the sitting meditation, or maybe it's, it isn't your experience, but it's not unusual, you know, sitting meditation, then, oh gosh, I can't wait for the walking meditation, you know, sitting, you know, enough. And then we come to the walking meditation, and it's nice for a little while, and then, oh, I can't wait to do some sitting meditation, this must be good, yeah. Yeah, and then here we come, sitting, just a moment, how about standing would be good, yeah. You can see how we always look to something else. And the idea that maybe what's happening right here is what we need to be looking at. In some ways, this is kind of radical. This is something remarkable and radical to undertake. Because we must ask ourselves here, what's really most important for us? What do we value most deeply in this life? If we spend our life trying to make it as comfortable as possible, I'm not sure in the end we'll feel that that has fulfilled and satisfied our hearts or left us with a sense of what it is possible for us to know as a human being in terms of peace, in terms of happiness. The society we live in, the culture that surrounds us, has, to my mind, a number of elements that are really unhealthy, harmful. The way in which we see that the materialist sort of attitude is made important, that we must all, you know, when all the banks did all the very stupid things the banks did a few years ago, I guess it happened here too, I don't know. And then everyone was told, you must consume more things in order to make everything better. If you can spend more money, if you can be more sort of consuming of things, it will improve our life. And it doesn't. I think probably you know this if you're here. Otherwise, why would you come to a retreat where you're not going to get a lot of things at the end of it? But that the atmosphere of our world is so strong in this regard. The values are so, it's so sad. You know, I remember I think earlier in the year, or maybe it was last year, I can't remember. There was a big headline saying all the important people were very concerned that there was less consumption of petrol. You know, gasoline. And it's like, this can only be a good thing if we use less of that stuff. But because it means that maybe people are driving less and spending less, it's a bad thing from one point of view. And this message is so strong around us that happiness comes through consuming more, through having more, through getting more. And it leads to a willingness in our culture to act in so many ways that are dishonest and harmful. And it's becoming more and more normal. More and more normal that this is how people, and not just people, but governments and corporations shall act. Because it's all in the service of having more, getting more, consuming more. Just today I saw in the news, don't worry, it's nothing that affects us directly in one sense. But it does. Because I saw that the Volkswagen car company, you know, this is now the biggest car company in the world. I don't know how many cars they make, but they're worth, it said something like $86 billion worth of company. For the last several years, they've been selling cars with a little mechanism Excuse me. They've been selling cars with a little mechanism in that can tell when you test it for its pollution, emission. And when it notices you're about to test it, it changes how it works, so it gives out very little pollution. And as soon as you stop testing it, it goes back to being very polluting. And they are about to get it, well, they are already in very big trouble because the American government has, you know, basically recognized and what's happening. But this happens in our corporate culture all the time. And what I found even more sad in a way, because this doesn't surprise me, it's crazy. This pollution kills people and harms our health and our planet. And this so cynical thing to make a little mechanism that can disguise how much pollution your car makes and tell you that it's not polluting when it is. Wow. And in the newspaper what it says, they apologize for a mistake. It's not a mistake. This cannot happen by accident. But that's how we get told the story of, oh, it was a mistake. The mistake, maybe they think, is we got caught. And I say this because this is the world we live in, and we need to understand that. The culture, the message of what is called real, or what is sometimes called, you know, the normal world, it's kind of insane. It's kind of crazy. And sometimes people talk about what we do here as this is retreat and that's the real world. I'm not so sure. I think there's something profoundly unreal about thinking that leads to that kind of outcome amongst people who are the, we could say, the leaders and the powerful people of our cultures who, you know, who lead companies that are bigger than, you know, many countries in terms of their economic force. So, just reading something like this, I think, gosh, it's so important that we do what we do here. It's so important that we engage in bringing something different into this world, in finding another way to live our lives. So, with this, we have to address a kind of fantasy that's here for us, that's part of the story that we're all told, which is that if we live in this way of materialism, if we try and always get more, because I think we know when we come to a retreat already that probably having more big, nice cars or things, although it might be helpful for our life, make some things easy, can even be nice, it's not going to give us lasting and deep satisfaction. Still, when we come to a retreat, or even when we've done many retreats, we can still have the underlying idea that a certain kind of experience, even maybe a spiritual experience, a meditative experience, that's what's going to do it for us. I don't need a nice car, but a nice meditative experience. Now that will be yes please. Yeah? And yet even experiences in themselves, even beautiful and powerful experiences that we may and can encounter in the journey, they are not what's most important. Because in and of themselves, no experience can give us lasting satisfaction. Think how many experiences you've had in your life already. How many feelings, thoughts, sensations, breaths, nice things have we had in our life already? Probably hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands. And yet they all come for a little while and then they change into something else. Everything is like this. And yet there's an idea we have that somehow I can find the thing, the condition, the experience in which finally I can just sit and feel this is good and I have the experience I want forever. No? You know, when we hear it, we probably know it's not true. But something in us doesn't always know that. It's always looking, always hoping that maybe very soon I will find it. And this lovely story of Mullah Nasruddin, who I guess you know of, a Sufi teaching figure, both a wise man and a fool, it seems, who was once on one occasion sitting in the village square on market day with a large pile of red hot chilies in front of him. And he's eating the chilies and his eyes are streaming, his nose is running, his face is very red, and it's obviously quite distressing. And his friends come and say, "Mullah, Mullah, why are you eating these chilies?" And no, actually, I got it wrong. They say, "What are you doing? What are you doing?" And he picks up a chili and eats it, and it's obviously very distressed. He says, "I'm eating these chilies." And they say, "Yeah, we can see you're eating these chilies. Why are you eating the chilies?" And he smiles, he says, "I keep hoping to find a sweet one." And it's kind of funny, of course, we can see the humor there, but also there's a way in which we keep hoping to find that ourselves. We keep looking somewhere, to something, to someone, to some situation. And that is what underlies that movement that keeps drawing us out and away. Because this chili isn't a sweet one, and so maybe the next one will. This experience, the content of it does not give me fulfillment, so maybe the next one will. And yet, what we need to understand, and what we begin to understand, is it is not the experience itself that determines most significantly the quality of our life, or the quality of how we experience our life. It's much more to do with how we meet it, what we bring to that experience, what we bring to this moment. And it's this that we're learning, it's this that we're developing and cultivating. So, this is a learning process. It takes us some time to understand what really works, what really serves. And it's good to give yourself some time and some space for this, to allow yourself to find your way, to not expect that already by now you would have worked out how to do it and be doing it very well. There's a lovely story of a student who went to see His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who was the teacher of this person. And His Holiness just was giving a very short audience to the student, and she had been a practitioner of meditation in the tradition of the Dalai Lama for many, many years, in fact over 20 years. She came to see him, sat down beside him, and started to talk about the difficult things that she experienced in her practice, and sort of hoping he would give her some very good answers to solve the problems and fix all these difficult things. And he said, the story as I heard it, he related, the Dalai Lama said after listening for some time, he said, "Yes, it's difficult, isn't it? Yes, I know. You know," he says, "it's like that in the early years of practice." And there's something for me lovely to think after 20 years, maybe it's just the early years. You know, it's like, okay, we have room, we're still learning, we're still growing, and maybe it's just the early days, not even the early years for us. But there's a radical transformation, a radical reorientation that this practice is asking of us, that it is calling for us, calling from us. And it does take time for us to find our way, to be patient with ourselves, to be allowing ourselves some space. And particularly if you find your mind is very busy, that it's pulling a lot or strongly, just coming back again and again to trust that that's okay, to do so with kindness and gentleness, as well as a clear intention. This is what serves. But not needing to measure or to evaluate how well or how often or how many times it happens for you. Just when you notice, come back. And having a sense of creating an environment for your heart and your mind of friendliness and of space. There's a proverb from India, which I don't know if you've heard, but I like it. It involves the question, it says, how do you fence in a rogue bull elephant? So, you know, a rogue bull elephant, like, kind of, it sounds like maybe an angry one. or something. But how do you fence in a bull elephant? Any fence you build, it can trample it. And the answer to the question is how? Oh, you put it in a very large field. If the field is large enough, it doesn't try to leave. So it's not like we're trying to contain with some force or control the activity of the mind. But wherever and whenever it goes, we notice, oh, it's here. Oh, gosh. Oh, wow, it did that. Oh, okay. Come back. Rather than, no, stop. Or this is bad. It's, You know, as I remember one of my teachers and someone I regard also as I feel very fortunate to know as a friend, Joseph Goldstein, the senior teachers of this tradition, he once said, you know, the mind, it has no shame. It does anything it wants to do. It doesn't care. You know? And it's like, oh, yeah, we can see that. Not judging, but, oh, look, that's what it does. That's how it is. And we can learn to train it, to guide it, to shape it in a way that transforms it. With that, to be aware if we start to judge ourselves, that we're not doing so well, that somehow, and this happens so often, that somehow maybe this practice, I don't think it works for me, maybe for some other people. You know, it's so common that someone will relate in an interview. They'll say, oh yeah, I was sitting, and actually my mind is busy, and I can't control it, and then it's sleepy, and I fall asleep, and then my knee hurts, and I hate it, and then I want to go home. And so I look around, and everyone else is sitting there so calm, so still. It's like there's just, you know, 60 soon-to-be enlightened Buddhas and one overcooked vegetable. It's like we have this idea and the person looking around gives up. I give up, you know. And then probably a moment or two later, the person next door looks at them and thinks, wow, they're sitting really still. They seem very calm and peaceful. So we don't know what's going on for each other. We do know. We can know what's going on for ourselves. But whatever is going on for you, and I've heard a lot of versions of what can be going on for you, and I've had a lot of versions of what goes on for me, it's all in the same territory. It's all in the same territory of what it means for the human heart and the human mind to begin to meet itself, to land more deeply with and in itself. And ultimately to come to know itself. Not according to just the content of what's happening, but what is more fundamentally true. What is its deeper nature? What is its potential? This we can know for ourselves. And it's the quality of presence, the quality of interest, the quality of care we bring to the breathing, to taking a step, to noticing that we've just worked out the recipe for how they made the trena, and it must be so. And we'll check it with the cooks tomorrow and find out and write it down. Or whatever we've done, if we liked something or didn't like something, what our mind does. To see wherever we see ourselves, this is the place we meet our life. And every experience offers us an opportunity for some learning, for discovery. It seems sometimes like it's a lot of work to be present, to be mindful, like why should I make all this effort? This question sometimes arises, why? Isn't it easy just to let my mind go and wander? Why keep coming back? Why keep doing this? It's true, it requires some effort because the forces of habit and reactivity are strong. The pressure of the patterns of craving and aversion that lead to a kind of a pursuing of or a rejecting experience of experience, rejecting of experience. These patterns are strong and they're deep. And it seems like it's easier to just go along with them, particularly because this is what's happening in much of the world. There's a proverb from, I'm not sure where actually, that says, only dead fish always swim with the tide. There's something that's not alive when we're carried along by this force, this momentum. It's not that we're to blame for the fact that it's here, but we do need to take responsibility for it. And in the end, although it is hard work to make that effort, to keep noticing, to keep reconnecting, it is work. It does take energy. Over time, it becomes more sustainable. It becomes easier because we develop that pathway. We support that capacity, and it becomes stronger. As any muscle, when we train it, it becomes stronger. And we're training this muscle, this capacity to connect, to open, to be present. But also, if we look, if we reflect, we see it's much more difficult and painful to live our life at the mercy of the mind in its spinning activity, in its uncontrolled and drivenness. And this is why people will administer an electric shock in preference to just experiencing this when they're not distracted from it, which is how mostly our world encourages us to be not even noticing what's going on. But when we notice it, actually it's uncomfortable. And yet it changes. As we sit, as we walk, as we stand, it starts to change. The very quality of care and interest that we bring, the kindness to receive even those things that are not easy for us, to allow the experience to be as it is, this starts to actually become the environment in which our life is happening. And it's this environment that starts to transform the way we experience it. Experiences may or may not continue as they are. That's in the end not the most important thing here. The mind will, over time, settle and become quiet. And yet when it does that, perhaps something else will show that will be challenging. Likewise, the body. Sometimes we may notice, it's kind of a bit painful or uncomfortable. And many times I've heard people describe that, when it stopped being uncomfortable, then the problem was they start to fall asleep. There's always going to be something. But when we start to see ourselves with compassion, look how it is for me to have a body that's sometimes uncomfortable, sometimes sleepy, sometimes hungry, sometimes it feels very good, and sometimes it doesn't. That's how it is for me, and for you, and for all of us, to have a mind likewise. Sometimes at ease, sometimes not. Sometimes inspired, sometimes tired of this, bored. Why am I doing this? What's the point of walking back and forth and back and forth and back? These people are crazy. Why are they doing this? We see our mind, it's stories. But we also start to see slowly in moments that just arise almost as if by accident, but it's not an accident, that suddenly we connect. And just for a breath, we're here. Or just for a moment, we feel what it's like when our foot touches the ground and we realize that our foot is alive. It's full of subtlety, of texture, of detail, of vitality, of vividness. And it touches us. Or we stand in a circle and we feel the presence of our companions. And I found it just so lovely this afternoon when we stood and just feeling the way that somehow we do it together and on the earth and with the trees. And trees are very good companions for standing meditation. It's like they're great teachers for this practice. It's good not to get competitive with them because they win every time. But some sense of, what's that like for us when we land in those moments together with ourselves? We can start to see the unfoldment of our lives. in a way in which there's more space around whatever it is that's happening. Because we do not any longer imagine that what it is that's happening defines who we are. Tells us whether we are a success or a failure. Whether we are worthy or otherwise. That what is happening is the raw material for our journey of awakening. Those things that touch us with delight, we can allow ourselves to be touched. To take them in. Those things that we find difficult, to allow ourselves to look and see what's difficult when something is difficult. What happens for us? So often, it's as much to do with the way we disconnect from the experience. And that sense of disconnection is more deeply painful than the difficult thing itself. So here we learn to connect, to reconnect, and in that very quality of connection, something starts to show itself. Something of the very presence of our life, the very nature of what it is to be a human being, in which there is something that we cannot quite take hold of or put our finger on, but which starts to speak to us quietly, quietly, quietly to begin with. But we start to hear that something in us recognizes, that something in us knows, because something in us has always known this. And it's something of what is here. It's something of what is now. It does not call with the loudest voice. But when we hear it, we understand that it speaks to us more deeply than often what is going on in the surface of the mind. And we have this capacity to know what it means as human beings to be awake, to wake up in the very midst of our lives, to know a profound degree of wisdom and compassion. In simple terms, to know how to live well in this world, to contribute to the happiness and the peace of ourselves, of each other, to live in the spirit of our shared humanity. And it's this for which we engage in this practice. It's this which we support by doing what we do here. And this is a good thing, a noble thing. So, thank you for your practice over this day. And as we continue together, let's just sit quietly for a few moments now to finish. So may we all together here practicing as we are on the retreat and in our lives, may we come to know for ourselves the depth of what is possible for us to connect and to understand this life, to live with kindness and with wisdom in the midst of it all, for our own welfare and for the welfare of all beings.